All right. I'm going to call this meeting of the Government Operations Committee to order. We do have a quorum. So the first item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes. We have 2 minutes to approve. Could I first have a motion to approve the minutes of the March 8th meeting?
So moved.
Representative Elkins moves approval of minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Next is the approval of the minutes of the March 11th meeting. I do have 2 corrections to make. On the bottom of the first page, it says that 2 bills were tabled, House File 910 and 970, and House File 703. That should say lays over, I think, instead of tables. Tabling is a formal action. They were laid over until there was a quorum present, and then action was taken on them. So I would just, with the correction that the word table at the bottom of page 1 be changed to lays over in both instances. With that correction, could I have a motion to approve the March 11th minutes?
So moved.
Representative Bonner moves approval of the minutes of March 11th. Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. So I think Representative Moran was the first one here. So that's House File 2057. I will move that House File 2057 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Would you like to present your bill, Representative Moran?
Yes. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. So House File 2057 is for a target group business certification. This proposal resurrects a change brought forth by the North Central Minority Supplier Development Council. It's a private industry group supporting suppliers diversity during the 2016 session. The proposed change will allow admin to accept certifications by nationally recognized certifiable bodies to verify that a business is eligible for the targeted group business program. In 2016, the proposal was included in the omnibus supplemental budget bill, but did not make it through the conference committee process. In 2018, this language was included in the department's policy bill, but did not receive a hearing in either body despite repeated requests. At present, the certifiable criteria and process is used by many private industry certifying groups such as the NCMSDC, which is the North Central Minority Supplier Development Council, are substantially similar to those of the state, with the exception that private certifiers charge a fee, have no cap on the size of the business, and do not verify whether the business is based in Minnesota, all of which are requirements to receive a target group preference under Minnesota law. The proposed change will streamline the process of becoming a targeted group business, which is like minorities, women, persons with disabilities, and veterans-owned businesses. For those businesses that are already certified by a private entity, by allowing the business to forego portions of the state certifying process. This change will allow admin to increase the number of certified businesses in the target group business program and will likely result in increased spending with diverse businesses. The proposal is an initiative by the department to improve the program and allow greater participation in state contracting by minorities, women, and veteran businesses. Mr. Chair, I have one testifier who is Betsy Hayes, who is the Chief Procurement Officer with the Department of Administration.
Yep. Thank you, Representative Moran. Welcome back to the committee after last night, Ms. Hayes. If you could just keep your testimony to a few minutes, we have a lot of bills. We're going to see if we can get through them this morning.
Actually, my name is not Betsy Hayes. She's not able to be here right now.
My mistake.
My name is Julie Byrell. I'm the legislative director at the Department of Admin. And I would just reiterate Representative Moran's comments. We think that this would just help a lot of businesses to do state contracting with us, and we think it would streamline it. And I would stand for questions.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Byrell. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House File 2057? Okay, seeing none, is there any member discussion? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just curious who
who recognizes or certifies the national organizations, you know, what governmental entity is generating this activity and enlisting them?
Ms. Byrell?
I'm not completely certain. I know that they're a federally recognized group, and so their criteria is extremely similar to our criteria in certifying the targeted businesses. So we feel that it would be useful to help businesses who are already certified under the federal certificate.
Representative Quall?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my understanding is the only entities that would be allowed to be considered federally recognized certifying organizations are ones that are recognized and somehow published by the federal government?
Ms. Byrell, do you have an answer to that?
I might phone a friend, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and answer the question if you can.
I apologize. Kurt Yoakum with the Minnesota Department of Administration. As Julie said, that our chief procurement officer was running a little bit late this morning. Representative Quam, Mr. Chairman, Representative Quam, to answer your question. Actually, all the requirements and all the parameters are set by both the federal agents. It's not necessarily a certification of the entities. It's that we set all the qualifications, all the requirements, and all the parameters of what has to be required, what type of paperwork needs to be submitted, and it's very similar to what the feds, especially let's say at the Defense Logistics Agency, require a veteran and the Department of Veterans Affairs for veteran-owned businesses. It's a pretty stringent list of requirements of what business ownership is, who has controlling stake in the business, size, net worth, and those are laid out both in statute and rule at the state level and also at the federal level.
Representative Quam.
Mr. Chair, I'm still trying to find an answer to my question. We're going out and it's in the bill, it's nationally recognized certifying organization.
Correct.
And the hints I've been getting is that it's federally recognized, mm-hmm. but I wanted confirmation that these are a federally recognized and published by the federal government, the list that mm-hmm. they're recognizing. And I haven't heard an answer to that question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Quam, I will have to follow up with you. The groups that we would be working with are certain groups such as the National Association of Minority Contractors, which has a national reputation and is nationally. This is who we worked with on this legislation.
Representative Quam.
Mr. Chair, there's a big difference if, you know, if the federal government acknowledges by publishing a list that they're saying are recognized, certified, is different than anecdotal conversations with entities. No offense to the entities, mm-hmm. but if we are taking, well, these are accepted by the federal government, then we should be going to something that's listed by the federal government so that it's officially acknowledged that they are accepted, because, you know, we don't want to have someone that was and then did something and isn't. You know, there's a lot of ambiguity. So my understanding is that there isn't a federal publicized list of recognized certified or certifying organizations unless someone, you know, informs me and the committee that there actually is one.
Okay.
And then we can choose from that list, as opposed to, you know, doesn't matter what parameters you get out there, if you have got confirmation that they meet those, then,
Mr. Chair,
you know, there's an issue.
Yeah, it sounds like it's not a organ. You know, the National Association of Minority Contractors. It sounds like it's not like officially designated in the Federal Register or someplace mm-hmm. like that as, you know, somehow being approved by the federal government. It does sound. I mean, I assume that is a credible, nationally certified trade association that's mm-hmm. regularly used by states around the country. So perhaps you could supply us with some information about their qualifications and what sorts of vetting they go through to be approved in other states for this sort of for this sort of work, and then we can share it with the committee members?
Certainly.
Okay. I don't know if you have any clarification to that as well?
Yeah.
No, Mr. Chair, I agree. And since these nationally recognized certified bodies will be coming through the Department of Admin, I mean, they have strict, you know, guidelines about who they are and what that means. So it's just not some entity out there in the world that is going to become recognized without the experience and expertise that the Department of Administration will bring to that selection process.
Mr. Chair, add on to Representative Moran's comments. Again, the statute and rule is very clear about who is eligible to be a certified business with the state of Minnesota, and so that we would get, when those certifications come, we would recognize those certifications, but they still have to, the paperwork and all the validations still have to come with that to the state of Minnesota that for us to actually verify also.
Yeah. If you could get us just some additional information about the organization and what's qualifies as their certification, then we can share with committee members. I think that would be helpful.
Mr. Chairman,
okay.
Of course.
Thank you. Any additional discussion? Okay. Any closing remarks, Representative Moran?
Mr. Chair and members, I think it's a good bill. It just really allows the department to improve the program and allow great participation in state contracting for minorities, women, and veterans businesses. So I hope that we can get your support on House File 2057. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Moran. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 2057 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Representative Moran. I think Representative Cantrell, would you care to go second?
Let's see.
Okay. Just kind of going by who I've seen in the audience here. So, and with committee members going last, unless there's nobody else here. So that's my system. Give me 1 second so I can just find your bill. It's House File 2053.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
And I will recommend that House File 2053 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. And I understand you also have an author's amendment. Is this just to put the bill in the shape you would like it?
Yes, Mr. Chair. This amendment was suggested by the Office of Management and Budget to ensure that this bill does not produce an additional incurred cost.
Okay. So I will move the A19-0183 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Representative Cantrell, would you like to present your bill?
Yes, I would, Mr. Chair, and I thank you and the members of the committee for the opportunity to testify before you today. I present to you House File 2053, a bill that will incorporate the Office of Enterprise Sustainability into the Department of Administration statute, and that is Statute 16B. This office was established a couple years ago by executive order to assist all state agencies with sustainability objectives in pursuit of the ultimate goal of reducing the output of greenhouse gas emissions produced by state government. The goal of this office is achieved through helping to develop plans to meet statutory sustainability requirements, tracking results at the agency and state level to ensure accountability of state government and agencies toward achieving sustainability targets in a cost-effective and cost-reducing manner, and finding subject matter experts to ensure that all necessary components of sustainability plans are thoroughly vetted to achieve optimal success. The office currently consists of 3 staff who are engaged in 38 projects in the pursuit of greater sustainability for our state government. The office produces annual sustainability reports, which are extremely interesting. I just read over their 2017 sustainability reports, about 20 pages long. And in it, they enumerate the various ways in which they have implemented plans or suggested plans for implementation to reduce inefficiency in our energy consumption and inefficiencies in our energy use to achieve sustainability across various sectors of government, including practices in procurement and practices in transportation. Let's see here. And at this time, Mr. Chair, I believe Erin Campbell may be here. She may not be. Oh, yes, okay. She is. Fantastic.
Great. Welcome back to the committee, Ms. Byrell. If you could please just identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
My name's not Erin Campbell. I'm Julie Byrell from the Department of Administration. Erin Campbell's on her way, but I would just reiterate Representative Cantrell's comments. The Office of Enterprise Sustainability has done a lot of good work, and we'd like to protect their office for the future.
Oh, great. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House File 2053? Okay, seeing none, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since we did the amendment which deleted Subdivision 2, I'm not seeing a lot of content in the bill that actually goes over state agency responsibilities. It's Section 2 also covered boards, some information there. So with this deleted, is there a gap in some definition that would be utilized to be able to effectively implement the program?
Ms. Byrell.
Mr. Chair, this was an amendment that was worked out with the Office or Minnesota Management and Budget to ensure that there would not be a fiscal impact on this bill. We feel that the Office of Enterprise Sustainability can still continue to function without that information and can still provide a good service for the state.
Representative Quam?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. If the cabinet-level agencies are not required to participate, doesn't it sort of defeat the purpose and the functionality? I understand the reason of trying to get rid of a fiscal note, but in doing so, if you gut maybe an integral part of the activity, it might be problematic. That's just my question and concern.
Okay. Sounds like it's a concern. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So relative to Representative Quam's question, if there's not going to be a responsibility for any state-level cabinet agency or basically state agency or department, who's it going to affect?
Ms. Byrell.
Mr. Chair, we currently have an interagency agreement with agencies to do this work. Every agency has a sustainability coordinator that works with our office, and we assume that that would continue.
Representative Vogel.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. So to the author, are we actually going to set up a new office, hire people to do something that we're already doing?
Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Vogel, for your question. This does not codify a new office. What this does is it includes the already existing Office of Enterprise Sustainability in the Department of Administration statutes. So they already have three staff who are working, and all this does is include the existing office within the Department of Administration statutorily.
Okay. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Cantrell, it says the Office of Enterprise Sustainability is established. So that's why I'm questioning what we're doing here, because it sounds like we're starting something new.
Representative Cantrell, Ms. Byrell.
Mr. Chair, so the Office of Enterprise Sustainability was originally created by the executive order, and they're still operating under executive order. This would simply put it in the statutes.
Representative Vogel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. So then when we go to page 2, which is now subdivision 2, local governments, it says that the office shall make reasonable attempts to share tools and best practices with local governments. If I'm a local government, that kind of scares me, because I'm thinking, okay, we've just now created in statute this office, which doesn't have really much authority over any state agencies, but apparently we'll be making what are reasonable attempts.
Ms. Byrell?
Mr. Chair, so currently local governments reach out to our Office of Enterprise Sustainability, and as best we can, we help them when they would like help.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So to Representative Cantrell, when I see reasonable attempts, I'm thinking that could go both ways. It could be that the city or the local unit contacts this office, but it could also be that this office is contacting the local governments to make suggestions, which might be looked at as, gee, I've got this thing going on, this grant application, whatever, I better start listening to what they're saying. So where is the assurance that when it shall make reasonable attempts, that the reasonable attempts won't be somewhat of an inducement for them to make those changes at a local level? Because quite honestly, with the deletion of Subdivision 2, it appears that that's the only real authority that it has here to do anything other than to exist.
Ms. Byrell?
Mr. Chair, that would not be the state's intent. Our intent would to be simply helpful to local governments. We would not be imposing anything on them.
Representative Vogel?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I can kind of see where the question is going, but I do really have concerns that we're memorializing something as an office rather than an executive order and not giving it really a purpose.
Representative Lehman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. I used to run a state agency, and I know that this, you know, different governors have different ideas, and I think this came under Governor Dayton. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's
Ms. Byrell, yes.
Okay.
Representative Lehman.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and testifier. So it looks like you've had some measurable success. We're looking at your report. I have a kind of a twofold question. Is were there new full-time staff required to implement this executive order? And if so, how many? Maybe I'll ask you that first.
Sure. Ms. Byrell.
Mr. Chair, the Office of Enterprise Sustainability houses three staff. I'm not certain. I assume that that was based off the executive order, but I could find that out for you.
Representative Lehman.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Testifier, so you know, if you might have up to three people, I just, having served in the executive branch, I know that there are significant costs involved in establishing a new agency in a separate enterprise. So my question is, wouldn't it make sense if the Department of Administration has oversight over the state's buildings, wouldn't it make sense to have this effort be under the umbrella of the Department of Administration? And what what are the advantages in having a separate entity versus assigning these responsibilities to the Department of Administration?
Ms. Byrell?
Mr. Chair, it would be within the Department of Administration. It would be simply an office that we would oversee. It's in our building. It's okay. In our department.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would appreciate it. It would be good to know how many full-time staff were hired as a result of this. Thank you.
And Ms. Byrell can follow up with this. Is there any additional member discussion? Okay. Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 2053, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No. Okay.
Motion carries. Thank you, Representative Cantrell. I see Representative Zhang is here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep. Thank you, Representative Cantrell. So we have House File 1714. And I will move that House File 1714 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. If you could, welcome to the committee, Representative Zhang, if you could please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, this title is just a little misleading. We're not looking to eliminate the community corrections from the county's duties and responsibilities. However, we are looking to eliminate a special statute that exists only for Ramsey County and was created prior to the county becoming a county corrections county. And I have with me today the Honorable Commissioner Victoria Reinhart, who will explain everything.
Welcome to the committee, Commissioner Reinhart.
Thank you.
If you could please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony and try to keep it 5 minutes or so, that'd be great.
Okay.
Thank you.
My name is Victoria Reinhart, Ramsey County Commissioner. I represent District 7 on the County Board. And before I get into the history of this statute and why we want it repealed, I do want to touch base a little bit on the idea of when I saw the title of this bill, I was like, oh my goodness, what are we going to do here? That's not what this is about at all. In fact, I will tell you what we have in place right now, and then I'll go back over the history of this. The county and court have formed a joint committee to facilitate ongoing collaboration and coordination. So, in fact, what this does, and I worked with Chief Judge Guthman on this, the courts support this, but for obvious reasons they're not up here lobbying. Judge Guthman did tell me that if anyone wants to call him, he can tell them that, yes, indeed, they are supporting this. But they don't do lobbying, is my understanding. Anyhow, so it actually expands what the courts and the county are working on together. It is the courts would now be involved in the hiring of the health and wellness deputy county manager. Instead of just having community corrections under this committee, we have community corrections, social services, financial assistance, public health, veteran services, and health care services. So it does not eliminate community corrections, and in fact it expands the authority with which we're working. And all of those areas, by the way, touch the judiciary, not just community corrections. So now we are Ramsey County has its own state governing statute, which is 383A. More specifically, 383A.404 gives joint oversight of Ramsey County Corrections Department to the county and the district court. Another statute, Minnesota Statute 401.02, which was enacted after the full state takeover of the courts, designated all community corrections counties, including Ramsey County, as the sole authority of their corrections department, giving them responsibility for funding, structure, administration, operation, management, and supervision. And last year, as I said, the district court and the county established the county court joint committee to explore better ways to work together and to resolve the ambiguities of current statutes 383.404, which should be repealed. And so basically this is something that is it's Ramsey County only, excuse me, and it's simply not needed, and we would like to have it repealed. Again, the courts and the county are in consensus on this, that it is something that should be repealed. And, in fact, we have something in place that gives the courts more authority over what we do. And the county really appreciates that. We've already taken on some bigger issues, such as children in need of protection and sex trafficking and other things that the judiciary and the county can work together on that goes well beyond community corrections.
Thank you for your testimony, Commissioner Reinhart. Is there anybody else who would like to testify on House File 1714? Okay. Seeing none, I will close testimony. Before going to member questions, House research has informed me that the title of the bill sounds a little concerning. But not only does it sound a little concerning, it's actually wrong.
Yes.
Because it doesn't eliminate the Ramsey County Corrections Department. So House research has informed me that as chair I can move to direct the reviser to amend the title to read relating to local government, repealing the special law for the Ramsey County Community Corrections Department. Since this is actually wrong, I'm inclined to make that motion. Is there,
Mr. Chair, I would support that. I would really appreciate it because I've been getting a lot of phone calls from folks saying, what are you trying to do?
Representative Zhang, sure. Well, with that assurance from the author of the bill, I will make that motion. Is there any discussion to the motion? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Zhang, I think this is one of a number of statutes that pertain only to Ramsey County. They're, as we go through the statutes, there's a lot of those things that just pertain to Ramsey County, and I think this is just a cleanup bill, and I think with the amendment to the language of the title, I think that'll eliminate some of the confusion that's going on and help us move forward. Besides that, it takes, as former Representative Biskins used to say, it takes words out of the statute books to make them smaller, so that's always a good thing.
Sure. Okay, so we are on the motion to direct the reviser to amend the title. Is there any further discussion to that motion? Okay, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, that motion carries. And then we are to the bill. Is there any further discussion to the bill? Okay, seeing none, any closing remarks, Representative Zhang?
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and members, for supporting this bill, and thank you, Commissioner, for being here to make sure we clean up language that no longer pertains to the county. And I would appreciate your support.
Thank you, Representative Zhang. So I will renew my motion that House File 2090, no, that's the House File 1714 as amended, even though it was just the title amended, House File 1714 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, motion carries. Your bill is on its way.
Thank you.
Sorry. Aaron is like man of yourself here. Okay, then how about, okay, so I'm going to start, neither Representative Mann nor Fisher nor Purcell are here yet, so Representative Nelson, would you like to take, present your bill? So this is House File 2122, and there is, I will move that House File 2122 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. And I understand you have an amendment also, Representative Nelson, the A1 amendment. Would you like to move that to put it in the shape you like?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'll move the A1 amendment. And what that just does, if you look on the bill, on line 1.7, there's a blank there, and this just fills in the blank with the date March 11th, 2019.
Okay. Any discussion to the amendment? Okay, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the bill is in the shape you like it, Representative Nelson.
And could
please
you,
present your bill.
Mr. Chair, what this House File 2122 does is ratifies the contract that was recently agreed upon between the self-directed home care workers that are represented by SEIU Home Healthcare Minnesota. And the new wages and benefits in the contract are funded by a different bill, which is going through a different committee, HHS Finance, as opposed to, we're not a finance committee. And the language of both bills and the are included in the governor's budget, which is also in HHS Finance. The contract has been submitted to the Legislative Coordinating Committee, the Subcommittee on Employee Relationships, which when they haven't been constituted yet for this year, but when they do meet, while we're in session, it's our responsibility to pass these. They just have an advisory role at the time. I want to thank Senator Howell, the chief author in the Senate, and this would be the third contract for these workers since they gained the right to form a union, and the contract covers approximately 2,900 workers in three self-directed care programs. They include the PCA Choice Program, where the clients qualify for hours of service and to budget the programs. Two budgeted programs, the Medicare-funded consumer-directed community support program and the state-only funded consumer support grant program. These programs are all self-directed, where the clients recruit, train, supervise the workers, and agencies serve only as a fiscal entity for payroll purposes. The contract does not apply to workers in the traditional or agency PCA programs, where clients go to the agency and the agency hires, trains, and supervises the workers on behalf of the clients. These workers are private sector agency employees not covered by this contract. They're covered under normal labor relations contract. I should note, however, that while these workers are not covered by the contract, the agency will receive the same rate increase and will be expect agencies will use the new funds to increase wages and benefits. This contract raises the minimum wage from $12 an hour to $13.25 an hour. This is important for three reasons. One is the higher wages will help fight the enormous workforce shortage that we face in this home health care industry. If we don't raise the wages in this industry, we will not be able to provide our care for our elderly and disabled residents, this care that they deserve. Even worse, if we don't provide them the care they need to stay in their homes and communities, all too often they will end up spending far more money for them to be cared for in traditional institutions. which are a lot more expensive. Second, it will allow self-directed consumers and also traditional agency employees to comply with scheduled phase-ins of the minimum wage increases on the ordinances in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And finally, the minimum wage will make sure that wages in the greater Minnesota will keep pace with the metro area. This contract also helps also makes improvements to paid time off and holiday benefits, and it improves the enhanced rate for clients who need more than 12 hours of care. Finally, we want to make these jobs the start of a viable career path and help workers who are too often isolated and as they navigate these programs. The contract expands the funding for worker training and provides for voluntary orientation program. And I think the MMB is here for
I have three details
of the contract.
Sure. I have okay, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, good morning. My name is Edwin Hudson. I am the Deputy Commissioner at Minnesota Management and Budget. Representative Nelson very eloquently, covered the terms of the contract, so I'll just be here and stand for questions.
Okay. Thank you, Deputy Commissioner Hudson. Is there anyone out? Do you have some additional testifiers?
There's one here.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please just identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
My name is Lauren Thompson, and I live in Champlin. Today you've heard about some of the numbers for the home care contract, and now I would like to share the reality of what that means for me and tens of thousands of Minnesotans across the state who are like me. I was born with cerebral palsy and rely on direct care services to survive. I need help with everything from getting up and dressed in the morning to meal prep to cleaning. I was a client on the PCA Choice program, but I could never get as much PCA coverage for the help that I needed, so my mom had to be my primary caregiver. After many years taking care of me, it took a toll on her, and she got hurt and couldn't take care of me anymore. So I had to move to a group home when I was 22. And then I had to move briefly to a nursing home. And I have now had to be in assisted living care for 6 years. And the staffing crisis has reached there too, with the client PCA ratio often being 11 people to one staff. When you hear the term care crisis, this is what we're talking about. I believe that Minnesota wants to be a caring place where everyone has the opportunity to live full, productive lives. But this isn't happening for thousands of Minnesotans like me. Our state's lack of investment over the years has meant that myself and others like me don't have the opportunity or the freedom to live like we want to, or more importantly, even live like we should. I've gone hours waiting for care. I've had to go unshowered at times, and I've gone weeks without a clean home. My exercise routine often has to be ignored because my care usually has to be about getting the necessities done. All these things can add to my physical pain, but emotionally it's draining too. It's hard for me to make plans to work or to do anything else because I quite simply don't know when I'll be able to get out of bed in the morning. I was on the bargaining committee for this contract because I want to fix the program so I can be on PCA Choice again and live a happier, more productive life. I believe this contract is a step in the right direction. The wage floor increase, the reimbursement rate increases, and the training increases are a step in the right direction. A $13.25 wage floor increase isn't going to solve the care crisis, and it's not going to bring enough new workers into these jobs to fill the 8,000 vacancies. But it's a big step forward from $12 an hour. And ultimately, to value home care workers is to value people with disabilities. Underinvestment leads not only to economic hardships, but led to deep social and moral disparities that are hard to quantify because our lives depend on these things. Our clients, for clients and workers alike, I ask that you take this step forward in passing the new home care contract.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Thompson. Is there anybody else who would like to testify on House File 2122? Okay, seeing none, is there any member discussion? Representative Lilly?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Nelson, thank you for bringing this forward. As you mentioned in your introduction, the Subcommittee on Employee Relations, you know, we're not reconstituted, but many of us are paying attention still of I was reappointed by the Speaker, and as were, five others. So we, but I think it's a good contract. I mean, I'm glad you're addressing the shortages, definitely that's, or working on that, that's so important, and I'm glad that you're making an effort that the MMBE is in doing this as well and settled. These people are so important to our, quality of life, and I'm happy to hear the testimony there because that was really powerful, but and then how important the quality care is as well. But thank you, Representative Nelson, for your work on this.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. Any additional member questions or comments? Okay. Seeing none, any closing remarks? Representative Nelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As I stated in my remarks, this saves the state money by being able to keep these people in their homes, living independently, and not in institutions. It saves the state money, and so therefore it's important that we pass this and try and get enough workers so these people can stay in their homes and in our communities.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 2122, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you for your testimony. Representative Mann, we have House File 684. Yes, and there is an amendment. So I will move that House File 684 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. We also have an A1 amendment. Is this just a bill in the shape you would like, Representative Mann?
Yes, Mr. Okay. Chair.
So I will move the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. The bill is in the shape you would like it. Please present your bill, Representative Mann.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members. Today we're talking about House File 684, which would establish a rare disease advisory council in the state of Minnesota. The amendment offered just changes some of the dates at which it would go into effect and adds a pediatric specialist to the board. So the state of Minnesota has long been a leader in medical advancement and patient care, with institutions like the Mayo Clinic, the U of M, and other world-class hospital systems. People travel from all over the world to get their care here in Minnesota. However, we do have a bit of a gap when it comes to rare diseases. A rare disease is one that affects less than 200,000 people in the U.S., and it's a disease for which there is no reasonable expectation that the cost of developing or making a drug for such a disease will be recovered from sales of the drug. So, therefore, only about 5% of rare diseases have any kind of treatment, and there's about 7,000 rare diseases. So what House File 684 will do is to establish this council with the U of M that would include physicians, nurses, administrators, patients with rare diseases, their caregivers, genetic counselors, and representatives from healthcare companies, medical research, and biotechnology industry. It would also include two members of the Senate and two of the House. Their duties, among others, would be developing recommendations relating to the quality and access to treatment, developing a list of publicly accessible resources for patients and providers, identifying best practices for care, identifying problems, unique problems faced by the patients with rare diseases and their families. Today with me is Eric Barnes, who has been a champion for this cause and for this legislation for years now. I would like her to speak today.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Barnes. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Erica Barnes, and I'm a Minnesota State Ambassador for the Rare Action Network. We're a grassroots organization of rare patients. Some of them are here with me today. So I'm also the founder of Chloe's Fight Rare Disease Foundation. I began my journey into advocacy after losing my daughter in 2010 to a rare disease. She had a aggressive neurodegenerative disease for which there's no current treatment or cure. And I really began the journey because it was a very isolating journey. I felt like I was alone. But after losing Chloe and getting to know other rare moms especially, but also dads and other rare patients, I started to see the same barriers to care being replicated across diseases, across all the rare diseases, over and over again. Same story, same story. And I began to realize that we need to have better policy. We can have better policy that will help rare disease patients. I wanted to give a few statistics to you just to underscore the need in the community. The average wait for a rare disease patient when they start to see signs and symptoms is 7 to 8 years to receive a diagnosis. Rare disease patients are misdiagnosed on average 2 to 3 times. This means sometimes that we receive ineffective treatment and sometimes even harmful treatments based on the misdiagnosis. And also, there are only 15% of rare disease populations have any sort of formal organization that's advocating for their needs. So this means that 85% of rare populations, patients are left trying to find their own specialists, trying to frantically find if there's any treatments or any clinical trials. So it falls on the patient to do this. So that is why I'm passionate about the Rare Disease Advisory Council, and I'm asking for you to pass the Chloe Barnes Rare Disease Advisory Council. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Barnes. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House File 684? Okay, if you could please come forward and...
Yes. I'm here with a newborn. I'm Carol.
Hi.
So I just got...
Why don't you wait till you... just for the tape, why don't you come up... Sit there, speak into the microphone.
Yeah, no, I will. I'm just getting my photo. Can I bring my baby, too?
Of course.
Okay.
We have one up at the table, too.
I'm in person. Okay.
If you want to pull the other chair up there.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Cagle.
I feel your pain.
I went, oh! Okay. I misread my email, and so I went to the Capitol building first, and I was like, whoops, I don't need to be there, and...
I appreciate all that. How about you say your name into the microphone for
okay.
for the record?
Can you help me just get him out?
Oh, how about you do that?
No, that's okay. Okay.
I'm sorry, I don't mean
no,
to
no,
stick
okay.
Here.
No, that's okay. My name is Carolyn Filstrom. I'm originally from St. Paul. I went to St. Paul Central High School. And I went to St. Olaf College, went to... the Lutheran School of Theology at Chicago. I'm an ordained Lutheran minister, and that's where I met my husband, Rory, who's also now a Lutheran minister at Christ the King Lutheran, and we live in Bloomington now. So I'm, full disclosure, I'm 35 years old. I was born in 1983, and I just had my first baby, and my sister and parents were always like, when are you going to have a baby? When are you going to have a baby? Is there a time limit? What is my time limit?
I am enjoying your story, but
okay,
yeah,
I'll give you
maybe
the
5 minutes, that would be
okay,
good. We
yep,
have a lot of
thank
bills
you,
on
five
the
minutes. Okay. And they were like, when are you going to have a baby? When are you going to have a baby? Our first pastor jobs was in North Dakota. North Dakota is one of the 43 states that is not yet currently screening for a disease that is the number one killer. Number one genetic killer of infants. That disease is called spinal muscular atrophy. Minnesota just started screening for spinal muscular atrophy on March 1st, 2018. 1 year and 13 days ago or so. What day is it today? Almost my dad's birthday. This is my son, Eden. He was born on October 8th, 2018. We had a great great pregnancy, other than the morning sickness, delivery went fine, healthy baby. 5 days after he was born, we got a phone call from our doctor saying, your son tested positive on the newborn screen for a disease called spinal muscular atrophy. This is a disease that, because he lacks a certain gene, his body cannot create enough protein to keep his motor neurons alive in his spine. Once your motor neurons are gone, they're gone. So, like, that's why, for example, like, we people who are paralyzed, like, that's permanent, right? Because science has not yet figured out how to regrow motor neurons. But thankfully, science has just figured out how to keep them alive. So we got this phone call on a Saturday when we were literally out the door to our regular pediatrician's office. We told her about it. She said, you're lucky your son was born when he was, because Minnesota just started screening for this disease on March 1st. And we just about fell out of our seats. We were so happy. He received the currently only FDA-approved treatment for this disease when he was 2 weeks old. And then a couple of weeks later, we got a phone call from from Dr. Randall Richardson, just over here at Gillette. And he said, well, I have some exciting news. There is a doctor in Madison, Wisconsin, who has a one-time treatment, a gene therapy. Are you all familiar with gene therapies? So there are these viruses that are harmless to humans, and they insert the corrected DNA into the virus, and they give it to you, they put it in your body, and then your body has the corrected DNA. So we were extremely grateful, me and my husband. We went to Madison, Wisconsin. We sat there for 1 hour when my baby here got a little liquid of corrected DNA. And that's it. The doctor was like, what side effects did he have? And I was like, well, he spit up a little more than usual for the last couple of days. Tomorrow I have to actually come back to Gillette because they're following his liver enzymes. And every time they're like, he looks great. His liver enzymes are normal. So if you Google gene therapy and then click on news, every day there's new stories about gene therapies. Anybody in here have a family history of Alzheimer's? I do. In May, Cornell School of Medicine is starting the first clinical trial for gene therapy for Alzheimer's. That's in 2 months. So, like, my cousins who are 40, now I'm talking to them about maybe we should all get the gene test for Alzheimer's, because by the time we're 80, I mean, genetics is just exploding. So I want to respect everybody's time, but there are many, many gene therapies. There's currently a gene therapy trial going on right now for the disease that Chloe Barnes had. And it's just real. I want to talk to you all more, and I'm happy to volunteer and just consult and do whatever I can to help, because there's a lot of complications around newborn screening. It's like, if we could be screening new babies for MLD, we could at least tell them, hey, there's a clinical trial going on right now in Boston where the results are amazing, just like my son's were. But in a lot of these diseases, if you wait until symptoms have already started showing up, then it's too late. You get what I'm saying? So, I want to respect your time, but what questions do you have for me?
Representative Zerwas, was your question for this testifier or to the bill generally? Or?
Comment.
Oh, okay. Go ahead and make your comment.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming down, and Erica, thank you for continuing to work on this. And Representative, man, this is a bill, an issue that I've been working on for the last several years. Yeah. You know, as someone that was born with a congenital heart defect and a rare disease, I've seen just in my lifetime the progression of medical treatment kind of across the board. And your little baby is just the miracle example of the advancements of science and technology. And so it's really an honor for us to have you here today and supporting this bill. The the bill itself, I think, is really important to establish the Council on Rare Disease to provide.
Okay, sorry. I just don't want to. You know how new parents hear their babies crying? They're like, oh no.
No, I
apologize. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, he's fine. He's absolutely fine.
Oh, thanks.
The goal of the Rare Disease Council is to provide parental support, patient support, and to help advise Minnesota on what we need to be doing better. As we look at addressing these issues, in your talks about gene therapy, one of the things that we have done over the last several years is pretty significant investments in regenerative medicine and setting up grant programs with the University of Minnesota and Mayo Clinic, and creating cooperatives over the last several years to fund really the next innovation of new science and technology breakthroughs in treating both unbelievably rare diseases and very common diseases like just regular...
Like Alzheimer's.
Like regular old Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
Or regular old heart failure. There's a phenomenal gene therapy program at the Mayo Clinic right now looking at using regenerative medicine in injecting... injecting healthy cardiac stem cells into hearts for single ventricle patients with born with a congenital heart defect. And so I was born with a three-chambered heart. I was born with tricuspid atresia, one a single ventricle. And so that type of research, I look at that, and it's just unbelievable.
Yeah.
You look at children that in 1980, when I was born, tricuspid atresia, that was 6 years. They told parents your child will live to be 6 years old, and
your parents were told that you had a life expectancy of 6 years old.
And what we found over the years is the doctors were wrong every time because of the advancement in science. And now what we're seeing is that single ventricles. I had 10 open heart surgeries over the course of the last 35 years. What we're seeing now. Is that parents, their new babies are being provided gene therapy treatment at a very young age and not having early surgical interventions. They're reinforcing the efficacy and the effort of their single ventricle, and they're able to sustain life much, much longer because of that therapy. And so I think your testimony today has encapsulated the importance of moving this forward and the importance of Representative Mann's legislation here today. So thank you for coming and thanks for spending some time with us. I assume you'll be at the rally.
I'm going to try. I'm probably going to go to my parents' house and rest for a little while and breastfeed and stuff. And then, I'll try to come back. He cries whenever there's applause, we've learned. I'll be there. I'll make it work.
That's a healthy-sounding cry, so I like it.
I should probably ask at this point, just is there anybody else who would like to testify on House File 684? I'll close the testimony. I'll go to member discussion. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in my district, it seems I have a number of people with rare diseases, and I have gone to the Rare Disease Network activities. So I guess the question I have is a little bit more about the relationship between whatever that network does and what you're proposing here. And is there a coordination between those?
Representative Mann?
Which network?
There is a Rare Disease Network, and I know that they've held activities in this building. And the reason I know that is because the last person in my district was diagnosed well over a year ago with a rare form of cancer. Unfortunately, she is at the U and she's still alive. But that's the first I ever heard of an actual organization that deals with this.
Ms. Barnes.
Yes, so I'm the
founding organizer of the Rare Action Network. I started a couple years ago. So the Rare Action Network is really focused on policy, just like the Rare Disease Advisory Council. So we're grassroots, and we really look at different policy issues that are going through the legislation, and we are growing our network. We're new and we're young, but we're trying to bring the rare community together to really look at the different policies in each state by state. So the Rare Action Network has been organizing to advocate for the passing of the Rare Disease Advisory Council, if that answers your question.
Okay. Representative Mason.
Thank you.
Okay. Any additional discussion? Okay. Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 684, as amended, be recommended to pass. And I'm sorry, did you have any closing remarks, Representative Mann? I usually...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it okay if Erica gives the closing remarks?
That would be fine. Ms. Barnes.
So again, I just want to reiterate, I wanted to tell a little bit of an anecdotal story to illustrate what's going on in the patient community. Right now, patients are really essentially being their own disease experts, their own fundraisers, their own advocates, their own healthcare navigators. That burden is falling squarely on the patients. And I remember one time after my husband and I had a fundraiser, and by the way, to raise money for medical research, we run a brat wagon at Cub, because that's what we know what to do. But obviously that's woefully inadequate for raising funds, but we're really the only ones raising funds. At the time, we're the only one raising funds for researchers at the U. And so after the fundraiser, my husband said, Erica, why do you keep trying to do it all? And I told him, because it all needs to get done. We have to have a resource for places to go for patients, and we have to have policy that makes sense. So this council would really provide infrastructure that right now is falling on the patients. So that's what I'd like to close with.
Thank you, Ms. Barnes. We do have one additional question, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And federally, there was a recent executive order about right to use, so that if you have a condition and there's not a lot of time, that, you know, a lot of the rare diseases, these are new and experimental, and allowing for accessibility. Are there any things, or are you considering things to remove obstructions to, you know, that type of option?
Ms. Barnes.
Yes, so the Right to Try bill, actually the National Organization for Rare Disorders, we had some real concerns around the Right to Try bill, and just some concerns around how that sort of left patients vulnerable to potentially enrolling in clinical trials and that weren't maybe as reputable. But certainly, I think you're right, the council would definitely take a look at some of the biggest barriers. Medicine is changing so fast right now. One area I think of immediately is diagnostics. Our ability to diagnose diseases cost-effectively and quickly is really taking off. And there's currently in the system some barriers that I think this council could look at. And just with the experts, again, I can't emphasize enough that this council would bring experts and stakeholders from all along the development and research pipeline. But because medicine is changing so fast, and research in rare diseases is kind of ground zero for some of this stuff, I think that's a wonderful use of the council.
Okay. Thank you. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 684, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you.
Thank you both for being here. I think I saw Representative Purcell in the audience. So we have House File 1998 here. I will move that House File 1998 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Representative Purcell, would you care to present your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, member of the committee. I do have a person, I don't remember her name, from the Department of Administration. I apologize primarily for questions or as they might arise.
We've had trouble identifying employees of the Department of Administration today, so don't worry about it.
I joined that group, Mr. Chair. Yeah. House File 1998 is a bill somewhat innovative, I would offer, but we're looking to expand, offer the expansion of solar energy generation on state buildings, and so it, as you can read in the bill, where the language specifically, we're going to expand or do away with the 300 kilowatt and limit it currently, and then allow solar to be put on state-owned buildings up to a percentage of the cost of installation. Try and keep that cost effective, but I would just offer, and it'll be very succinct. There's a lot of things I could say, but in the interest of time, I will just say that initiatives like this certainly in the long term will save taxpayer money, and I'll attest to that. I don't have solar, but at my home I have a wind turbine, and it saves me electricity money. I generate my own, and if we can do that, the electric bill is going to be smaller for the state of Minnesota over the long term. So that's why I'm carrying this bill. That's why I support this initiative. So I'll leave it there, Mr. Chair, if that's okay.
Sure. Thank you, Representative Purcell. Welcome to the committee. I'm going to guess that you're Aaron Campbell. Okay. But if you could please say that for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Aaron Campbell. I'm one of the assistant commissioners at the Department of Administration. I am actually just available to answer questions. I don't have any prepared remarks.
Okay. Sounds good. Is there anybody here who would like to testify on House File 1998? Okay, seeing none, is there any member discussion? Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Purcell, looks like there isn't a Senate companion to this bill. Do you have a Senate author and the bill just hasn't been introduced yet?
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and we're still in search of an author in the Senate.
Representative Zerwas.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm kind of wondering, as we look through the agenda here, House File 1239, House File 2084, House File 1998, House File 2053, House File 2055, House File 2056, and House File 2057 are all bills that we're taking up time to hear today, and are all bills that don't have a Senate companion. And so I'm wondering, Mr. Chair, what the intention is of moving bills that in the last week of first deadline haven't been introduced in the Senate.
Thank you for the question, Representative Zerwas. I mean, we don't follow exclusively what the other chamber does here. If they make deadline here, they can still be introduced in the Senate and have time to meet the second deadline. So it's not a prerequisite of a bill for there to be a Senate companion. Obviously, it's preferable, I think I would say, from the author's standpoint. But our job here is to consider legislation and decide whether we think the House thinks it's appropriate.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, 7 of the 15 bills we're hearing today don't have Senate companions, and I think that's a little odd. And I think it may not be the most efficient use of the committee's time, but it's your committee, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for the comment, Representative Zerwas. Was there any additional member discussion? Okay, seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 1998 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Your bill is on its way, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
sure.
I guess, is Representative Fisher here?
Oh, so of the 14 bills.
Okay, Representative Lee, would you like to present your bill? I will move that House File 2059 be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register. Representative, and we've essentially heard this bill as part of, this is a provision within Representative Long's census bill, but I know you've worked hard on this provision too as well, Representative Lee, so would you like to present your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. House File 2059 is a bill to allow for U.S. Census workers to have access to apartment buildings, and you know, with the upcoming 2020 census, it's really important for us to get the most accurate count that we have, and we had some updated number that were shared to me with the state demographer in her office saying that the state of Minnesota, we're receiving about $15 billion in federal funding, and if we do not count every resident here in Minnesota, we stand to lose $2,800 per year or $28,000 per person per decade. And so I have the state demographer here to highlight some of the needs as to why we need to have the most accurate count, which we did have a discussion around from Representative Long's bill, and also to talk about the bill.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, my name is Susan Brower. I'm the state demographer, and I really do work in the Department of Administration, too. There's a theme. I'm here to talk about the census. It's really important to Minnesota for a number of reasons. It's important because it's the way that we apportion, or that the federal government apportions, congressional seats to the state. Just like in 2010, we are very close to losing or very close to keeping our 8th congressional district, and so we want to make sure that we have a complete count to ensure that we have the very best chance of doing that as possible. In addition, the census provides the foundation for a fair democracy. As we move into legislative redistricting, it's going to be important that we have a full and complete count of everyone in Minnesota to ensure that our districts are fair and capturing the people that we think are indeed there. We focus specifically on renters because renters are among the group that is most likely to be missed by the census. If we look at a geographic area and the characteristics of that area, renters by far are the strongest factor that would account for an undercount. So we want to look to make sure that we are removing barriers to the extent that we are that we can to renters and between the census workers and renters. And so we think that this bill will do will help move us in that direction of a complete, accurate, and fair count for Minnesota.
Good. Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Brower. Is there any additional testimony on House File 2059? Okay, seeing none, any member discussion? Seeing none, any closing remarks, Representative Lee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for the opportunity to present this bill. And like I said, I think that it is critical for us to, do what we can at the state level to ensure that we get the most accurate count that we can get and maintain our congressional seat. So thank you, members.
Thank you for your testimony. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 2059 be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, motion carries. Your bill's on its way. Is Representative Fisher here? Okay, Representative Lilly, would you like to go? So you have House File 2055. I'll move that House File 2055 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. Welcome to the committee. Please present your testimony, Representative Lilly.
Good morning. I don't even know what time it is anymore. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for having us. My bill is pretty simple. It's supposed to be a cleaning up bill for historical society issues. It's mostly technical. For example, one of them is just changing the name of the state Historic Site Program to the State Historic Preservation Program. But with me, I have Mr. Joachim. Joachim, and he can go through the bill to the detail that you want, if you need it. To Representative Zerwas's question, I did quickly jump and look at to see if there was a Senate companion, and there is none, so maybe he can address why there isn't. And I don't have the answer, but I was kind of curious myself, and because I thought this was mostly technical, but I'm sure, you know, anyways. I'd like to pass it to...
Sure. Welcome back to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with the testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Kurt Joachim, Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Administration. And thank you for hearing House File 2055 this morning. And thank you to Representative Lilly for his willingness to carry this. This emanates from the 2017 legislation that transferred the State Historic Preservation Office from the Minnesota Historical Society to the Department of Administration. And what this bill is a technical housekeeping bill that cleans up several references that were not caught during the change and corrects one inadvertent change during that was made during 2017. Basically, Section 1 I should say that this bill was worked on between Department of Administration and in collaboration with the Minnesota Historical Society. So both entities are in agreement. David Kelleher was planning on being from the Historical Society was planning on being here if there was an evening session on this bill. So, but he wanted me to let you know that the Historical Society is in full support of this. But basically, this bill amends in Chapter 138, which is the state authorizing section of statute for the State Historic Preservation Office. Section 1 amends the Historical Society section of Chapter 138, which properly references State Historic Preservation Office work and updates and properly cites the federal citations which the State Historic Preservation Office derives its federal authority. Sections 2, 3, and 4 amend the Field Archaeology Act, basically defines SHPO as SHPO to the entities that enforce that, and that also just clarifies that violations that occur on state archaeological sites are reported to the Office of State Archaeologists, which is practiced currently. Sections 5, 6, and 7 amend the Historic Sites Act, clarifies who's involved with review processes and the challenges, and where the agency should be submitting plans for takings that involve state funds. And finally, Section 8 is updating the reference for the St. Paul St. Anthony Falls Heritage Board that SHPO actually sits on that board. And basically, that is the bill in a nutshell.
And I assume the Senate version is in the works?
Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding that the Majority Leader's office in the Senate is finding authors for all of these bills right now.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Joachim. I was kind of wondering that, too, because I have a Department of Administration bill, and I did the same thing as Representative Lilly and double-checked, and that falls into the same category. So is there anyone else who would like to testify on House File 2055? Okay, seeing none, any member discussion? Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to the testifier, it looks like on line 3.17 in that section, we're making some changes to the mediation or change it to a review process. If you could just talk through what those changes are, it looks like it's changing the makeup of the review board. So I'm just wondering if you could kind of talk through those.
Yeah, Mr. Joachim.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zerwas, there's actually no change to the actual process itself, but formally the with the State Historic Preservation Office being at the Minnesota Historical Society, that that limited what the Historical Society was the type of member type of appointee should this situation ever need to occur. And so basically, this this updates the reference to any challenge to a designation that the or finding that the State Historic Preservation Office should make, and then it updates that the Minnesota Historical Society could actually appoint a member or employee. Now, previously, they would not have been allowed to, since that would have been a conflict of interest, since they would have been also the parent entity of the SHPO.
Representative, any additional discussion? Okay. Any closing remarks, Representative Lilly?
No. Thank you, Assistant Commissioner, for coming and helping. I
I was concerned that you'd ask some difficult questions, Representative Zerwas, but luckily you passed them to him. So,
All right, with that, I will renew my motion that House File 2055 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you.
Yep. I still don't see Representative Fisher, so I think I will go with Representative Mason. Now, I apologize to the people who are here to testify for my bills, but I have three of them up, and I think it probably makes sense to do them all at once at the end, and so we only have to switch off the gavel once. Okay, thank you. So I will move that House File 192 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. Representative Mason, if you could present your bill.
Thank you. House File 192 addresses some changes to the Metropolitan Council. We know that there's been a lot of controversy with this group organization over the years, and this makes some of the some changes that we think will help. And one of them is the fact that it puts in staggered terms. So the thought is that I'm looking at this as a good governance piece because there will now be more continuity in the Metro Council that has been missing when the entire new slate starts every time that there's a new governor. The other thing, the major change that is being made in this is the appointment of people to the Met Council. There's we're giving more more authority to, like, the League of Cities, Counties organizations. And it is my thought that this is, the Met Council is a regional organization, so the fact I see very little reason why the governor should be having a major impact on what's happening on a regional organization. So you will see that under appointments or recommendations, it would give the governor changes the number that the governor can appoint till five, gives the League of Cities five, and gives the counties three. Those are the major changes that this bill does have. I'm trying to think if there's anything else that you... And it also is trying to give more authority to the recommendation, to the group that is doing the recommending of the suggested people to the council. And I think there's at least one person that would like to testify on this.
Sure, and I'm going to actually withdraw my motion because you have both the subcommittee engrossment and the original bill. So I believe the motion I should have made first was to adopt the subcommittee engrossment, which is what you just explained to us. So
exactly.
So it's kind of like adopting an author's amendment. So all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Okay, the bill is now before us in the shape that was described. So welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, excuse me. My name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities, otherwise known as Metro Cities. And before I begin, I also have, if I could ask a page to deliver, I've Executive Director Fahua Hoffman of the Citizens League could not be here today, but she wanted to ask me if I could share a letter of support from the Citizens League for this bill as well. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to provide comment on House File 192 today. Just for very brief background, Metro Cities does represent cities across the metropolitan region at both the legislature and the Metropolitan Council. Metro Cities does support the provisions of House File 192. The organization has had a longstanding position in support of staggered terms for the selection of Metropolitan Council members and also has taken policy positions to support increasing both local official input on a nominating committee, both by expanding the size of the committee, as is done under the House File 192, and increasing the opportunity for local official input into the nominating committee process. Metro Cities also does support increasing transparency in the appointing process for Metropolitan Council members by providing for a public comment period before members are named, and does support additional accountability for a governor to provide some information to a nominating committee if he or she does not accept the recommendations that are provided to him or her. And with that, I will close and would be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair and members.
Sure. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House File 192? Welcome to the committee. You can pull up an additional chair if you want, or okay, that's fine too. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
There. Mr. Chair, I'm Kathy Saltzman. I represent Scott County on this issue, and I want to thank Representative Mason. We've had talks over the years about this bill. This bill is very similar to a bill that I carried in 2008 and was vetoed by a GOP governor. So it's not a partisan issue. I think it's something that's been discussed for a long time. In terms of this bill, I've spoke with Representative Mason. I truly appreciate her efforts to talk about reform. Scott County would believe that staggered terms is a very small step. It's not enough. The other provision that we are very concerned about is on line 118 and 119 that removes a member serving at the pleasure of the governor. And I understand that this is removed so that between administrations, one governor could not basically remove the staggered terms and then remove people that had not been appointed by him or her. But the issue comes down to then accountability, that if you appoint members to the Met Council, the governor appoints, and we would argue that where's the accountability because you don't have elected officials, it's just the governor. When you remove that, then members serve without any accountability at all. Someone could not even attend meetings and then could not be returned unless there was a gross sort of behavior issue. So I would just probably, I guess, encourage that if this bill does move forward or ends up in an omnibus bill, that you consider that. I know that in the past there's been discussion about why that was kept in, so that there is at least the governor is accountable for the decisions made by the Metropolitan Council. So with that, I just want to thank you very much for this time to testify.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House File 192? Okay, seeing none, Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the testifier just asked one of the questions I was going to ask because I was wondering where the accountability is, but maybe if Representative Mason would be so kind to answer where is the accountability if this goes into effect?
Representative Mason?
Thank you. That's an area where we are still working on, and I understand the point. And that part of the reason for the changes that I've been, that are in the bill is so that there is more accountability at the local level. But as I said, we haven't covered all the bases yet.
Representative Vogel?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative, for considering that. The other concern that I had was on 317 and 318, where it says the governor is not required to appoint from the list. So what we're doing here is we are setting up a better system to look at who would be the possible finalist, but we're really still giving the governor the right to choose whoever he or she wants. And you know, a lot of the talk on this has been to the Met Council is got the ability to tax without elected officials, and it one of the few bodies that I'm aware of, if there are any other bodies that have taxing authority, and yet the officials are not elected, and that would continue under this. And it's always been a concern of mine that we give taxation power to people that are appointed, and we're still doing the same thing here. So I gather this is maybe a little bit of work in progress yet, and I won't ask a question necessarily, Ms. Chair, but I certainly would like us to address the issue that we have had, which is a body with taxation authority not being elected people that can be changed by the people that are being taxed. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Vogel. Representative Elkins?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
To this point.
To
To Representative Vogel's last point, I'll just observe that the Metropolitan Council does have the authority to levy, their authority to levy is capped by us. So we limit the amount that they can levy. The vast majority of the funds in the Met Council's budget are from either federal sources passed through or from user fees for things like bus fares and sewage treatment fees. So the amount of the Met Council levy is quite small. And I would say with respect to the deleting the words about the member serving at the pleasure of the governor, I think you have to consider that in concert with the fact that we would, if this passes, be giving the local elected officials much more say in the selection of the members. In my experience, as long as the council serves at the pleasure of the governor, it might as well be a department of the state government, because basically the decisions all come from the top down rather than from the council up.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe that this body also restricts and caps certain taxation capabilities of elected entities that have taxing authority. My understanding is this is a very unique amongst the United States of a group of unelected officials having such power and authority. And I think that's the main point, is when we have stern vision, oversight, etc. on this, it's because this is a unique beast that we birthed, well, our predecessors birthed. And I and other members continue to see an issue with that. I mean, there was a Tea Party for similar reasons in our history.
Thank you, Representative Kwan. I guess I'd just point out this, the bill is addressing the composition of the Met Council and the appointing body behind it too, and that's sort of what's before us too. Another bill could be introduced to address the issue of taxation as well, but not every bill needs to address every issue. Representative Vogel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and because my name was brought up relative to the funding thing, I realize that not everything comes from the levy that's going on to the property tax, but the body itself it needs the support of all kinds of different tax revenues to support its operations, and that was my point, is that we've got an unelected body that's making decisions with over $1 billion a year, and that's where my concern is with this bill, that we're not entrusting that power to elected people rather than appointed people. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Vogel. Any additional discussion? Representative Elkins.
I just observed that I'm not philosophically opposed to having an elected Met Council, but that would bring a whole host of other issues to the table as well.
Okay. Thank you. Seeing no additional member discussion, any closing remarks, Representative Mason?
Well, a couple. When I was on the City Council, and especially when I was lobbying for on transportation issues, just going to the Met Council and coming to the legislature was hectic enough, and at that point, and that was not with an elected official on the Met Council, and I'm thinking that might make things even more complicated. But I do want to say, this year we do have the local government committee, where we are trying to focus on the Met Council, so I'd appreciate any suggestions or topics that you'd like us to have. And then also, we also have the Legislative Commission on Metro Governance. So there is, if we really work hard at it, I think we can get to a resolution, and that's my intent. And I'd appreciate your support.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. I will renew my motion that House File 192 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No. Yeah. Motion carries. Representative Fisher is still not here, so I'll start with mine.
He was here.
And I'll start with House File 1994. And I'll move that House File 1994 be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register. I also have an A2 amendment. Not in front of me. Oh, yes, I do have it. So I'd like to move the A2 amendment. Put it in the shape I'd like it.
Is anybody... Oh, I guess we just can vote on that. Is anybody and everybody in favor of the A2 amendment?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, go ahead.
I think the amendment was adopted.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll take that yes as a yes it was. This bill was presented in the election subcommittee. It does touch on county government, so it should probably also be heard here. Several of the laws governing campaign finance in Hennepin County are unique to the county and are outdated, or in some cases conflict with state law. House File 1994 does two primary things. First, it repeals the campaign finance sections of 383B in the Minnesota statutes, and it replaces those provisions with either Section 211A or 10A provisions. These changes provide more clarity to candidates, political action committees, and citizens, and it ensures there's appropriate and timely disclosure of campaign finance information. Currently, candidates running for office in cities with a population greater than 75,000, which is the cities of Minneapolis, Bloomington, and Brooklyn Park in Hennepin County, or running for the Minneapolis School Board file with Hennepin County. Under this bill, candidates running for county office will continue to file with Hennepin County, but all candidates running for local offices will follow Chapter 211A and file with the local office for which they are running, just like everywhere else in the state. And also under current law, political action committees, or PACs, active in Hennepin County elections or in Minneapolis, Bloomington, Brooklyn Park, or the Minneapolis School District must file with either Hennepin County or the Campaign Finance Board. House File 1994 provides that PACs active in these races must file with the Campaign Finance Board. By doing so, this bill fixes a gap in reporting requirements for PACs operating in these races. Under current law, these PACs, if registered with the Campaign Finance Board, do not file with Hennepin County. So when there are odd-year elections like those in Minneapolis, these PACs follow current off-year Campaign Finance Board reporting, which only requires a year-end report. So under current law, there's not sufficient transparency on PAC contributions in these elections, and this bill fixes that. With me today is Dan Rogan from the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, and Ginny Gelms, is it? Yeah, okay, the Hennepin County Elections Director, to go over the bill. We did discuss it in Elections Subcommittee, too, so they can be pretty brief here, I think.
Okay, please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, I'm Dan Rogan from the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, and Representative Freiberg did a nice job of explaining the need for the bill. I'll just quickly go over what the sections of the bill do. It kind of goes, the easiest way to look at it is in reverse order. If you start with Section 22, which is at the end, it is the section that deletes a significant number of the, or all of the election provisions from 383B. And then Section 21 of the bill amends one remaining section so that it makes it clear that 211A applies, as Representative Freiberg said, to all of the city races and that for all the local jurisdictions. And then it makes it clear that political action committees and political funds that previously were required to file with Hennepin County now will file with the Campaign Finance Board. And as Representative Freiberg talked about, that will make sure that disclosures are timely, and it also then in the in sections 1 through 20 it makes some changes to 10A to make it clear that these political funds do need to file with the Campaign Finance Board, and it sets up an additional disclosure period in off election years for those political campaign committees or political funds that do make those off year contributions. So it effectively just moves the reporting location from Hennepin County to the Campaign Finance Board. And it increases the disclosure, as Representative Freiberg talked about. And we have worked with the Campaign Finance Board, and they have worked with us on the language of this and believe that they can implement this with their current staff. And I think Mr. Sigurdsson is here if there's any questions about that. Ultimately, this will only impact about 24 political action committees or political funds that are active in Hennepin County that don't currently file with the Campaign Finance Board. So those ones will have under this bill, would now be filing with the Campaign Finance Board. But other than that, it really is just moving what is in 383B to the other campaign finance laws that the state has right now. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Are you going to have additional testifier?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Kenny Gelms. I'm the elections manager for Hennepin County and happy to help answer any questions members may have.
Okay. Are there any other testifiers? I don't see any. So, members of the committee, any questions?
Mr. Chair, I understand there's an issue with the there should be a subcommittee engrossment in members' packets. So I think probably the appropriate thing to do would be just to lay this over for the moment. The page I know is making copies of it right now. So we could just lay this over for the time being. And then once the subcommittee engrossment's been distributed, we can take up the other two bills. Once the subcommittee engrossment's been distributed to members, then we can retake action on this one.
Okay, with that explanation, we'll lay this one over until it is physically available.
Thank you. So I appreciate members' indulgence on that issue as well. So House File 2097 is the next bill. This one should not have any issues with engrossments or anything. So I will move that House File 2097 be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register.
Go ahead and explain your bill.
So Hennepin County is in the process of hiring a new library director. However, under Minnesota statutes enacted in 1981, the library director is required to have an advanced degree from an institution accredited by the American Library Association. This restriction, which impacts only Hennepin County, is an impediment to getting the most qualified people for the job. The Hennepin County library system is one of the best in the country, and they take the library director position very seriously. But not only is the county limited in who they can offer the position to, many qualified candidates have not even applied due to the requirement that this person have a master's in library science from the ALA-accredited college, from an ALA-accredited college or university. There are many good candidates who have other advanced degrees and have years of experience running large library systems, but this antiquated state law prohibits the county from hiring them or even considering them for the position. House File 2097 simply removes the restriction that a candidate have this particular advanced degree and says that the person will be qualified by any experience or qualified by experience in education. Making this change will allow Hennepin County to appeal to a broader, more diverse range of candidates while keeping in place an important reference to education. With me today is Michael Rossman, Chief Human Resource Officer for Hennepin County, who can give you more details on the county's hiring process, their current search, and how this bill would help the county maintain our world-class library system.
Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, Representative Michael Rossman, Hennepin County's Chief Human Resources Officer. Thanks for allowing me this opportunity today. Hennepin County makes every attempt to recruit and retain the best leaders for the organization. We have made significant progress reassessing where there are real and perceived barriers that stop us from getting great candidates and opportunity to lead in our organization. We recognize that those leaders can come from a variety of education and experience that cross multiple fields of expertise and industries. Removing the requirement for the library director to have the Master's of Library Science degree will open up the possibilities to consider more well-qualified candidates and almost surely attract more diversity to the candidate pool. Hennepin County workforce goals include attracting and retaining a workforce that is representative of the community we serve, and this applies to employees at all levels of the organization. We just completed an initial recruitment for the library director, and because of the MLIS requirement, the pool of candidates was very limited and had relatively no diversity. We want to ensure we have left no stone unturned in searching for the next leader of this nationally recognized library system of 41 libraries and over 800 staff. The American Library Association considered dropping the MLIS requirement for their executive director position last year. In the end, they kept the MLIS degree as required, but several library systems around the country have dropped the degree requirement or are moving to a preferred rather than required status for that. The MLIS degree remains very important and significant to our library system. Hennepin County Library's senior team of managers and leaders includes many managers with MLIS degrees, and their expertise guides the library along with that of their colleagues who have other educational backgrounds. Good libraries pull together the staff we need to provide our communities with excellent library service: librarians, customer service professionals, IT and technical staff, community liaisons, and so on. The person who leads the diverse components of the library organization needs strong management-based experience, which can be obtained in a variety of ways from a variety of career backgrounds. So I want to thank you for allowing this time to speak today on this important topic for us.
Is there any other testimony that?
Okay. I don't see any, Mr. Chair.
Then on this bill, Representative Plum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And is this position exempted from the limit we have, or cap we have, and what is the current salary?
Mr. Chair. It is slightly exempted from the salary cap. I don't have that information with me, but there's about a $4,000 to $5,000 exemption over the current salary cap, and I believe that puts this position at about $184 annually.
We could,
yeah.
Mr. Chair, yeah, we could get you, Representative Quam, the exact figures too.
Mr. Chair, that my general intent is to understand whenever a position is brought before us and we're changing qualifications or modifying responsibilities, that we understand if it's an exempted position. Thank you.
Any other questions, members of the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Wondering, Representative Freiberg, why do we set the Hennepin County Library Administrator qualifications in state statute? That seems so odd to me. What's the, do you know the history behind this? It just seems so odd.
Is that a comment or a question that you, I guess why, yes. Go ahead, Representative Freiberg.
I believe there's a whole, and Mr. Gehring can maybe, or I'm sorry, Ms. Dyson can confirm this, but I believe there's a whole chapter of the Minnesota statutes that deals with Hennepin County. I think Ramsey County might have one as well. Those might be the only two counties, just being, I think, the earliest developed counties in Minnesota. That I think they were treated somewhat uniquely under state law. But I should probably stop talking and just defer to the expert. It would be Ms. Dyson.
Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair and members, there are actually five chapters in statute that are special laws for counties in the metro area and St. Louis County. And they differ in what is included in the special law. You're right, most special laws are not codified, but the decision of whether or not to codify a special law is often determined by, you know, who is the audience. And in this case, the merger of the Minneapolis Public Library System with the Hennepin County Library System, which was not that long ago, within the last 10 years, is part of it's now part of the Hennepin County statute. But there are five chapters of special laws specific to counties.
Good luck.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that brings to mind at the time that this was first put into statute, were there state funds that were flowing, and therefore there was more state involvement, and that's why the additional parameters, just a curiosity.
Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Quam, I have no recollection of it being a financial matter.
Any other questions? Where does this go?
General Register.
You made the motion.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So just in closing, this is a great bill that makes the chapter of Minnesota statutes dealing with Hennepin County even greater. And so I would renew my motion that House File 2097 be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The bill is on its way.
Mr. Chair?
Are you going to? Yes.
Just a clarification, even greater, is that the same as huge?
No. No. No, it's not.
I'll leave that as an editorial comment.
move to strike the record.
Thank you. I would like to move to House File 2056. Okay. So I will move that House File 2056 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
Okay. You want to introduce the bill?
Sure. So, this bill would expand emergency authority and state procurement to design consultation. In emergencies, Minnesota statute section 16C.10 permits the commissioner to waive the solicitation process for goods and services to repair state facilities or purchase necessary goods. There is one exception for design consultation. A recent situation highlighted where this has proven problematic. So from March to early June 2015, 110 turkey and egg-laying farms were diagnosed with highly pathogenic form of avian influenza, or HPAI, and about 9 million turkeys and chickens or laying hens had died or been euthanized to fight this outbreak. A state of emergency was declared in April 2015. Emergency funds were appropriated to the University of Minnesota to design and construct a laboratory facility to improve research and response capabilities. The University of Minnesota was able to directly contract for construction, but was required to utilize the state designer selection board process for selection of the design consultant. The University of Minnesota was also unable to utilize design-build delivery methods due to the requirement for the selection process. During the emergency in 2015, real economic damage was incurred, and there was a delay in alleviating public health concerns. Under the proposed change, the Commissioner of Administration could provide for expedited selection of a design firm in emergency situations. This change aligns with the national and state conversations around national preparedness. Emergencies are unpredictable, and any delay has the potential to continue to put the public at risk for both financial damages and public health. Wayne Wozlaski, our Senior Director of Real Estate and Department of Administration's Senior Director of Real Estate and Construction Services is here to testify.
Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is Wayne Wozlaski, Senior Director for Real Estate and Construction Services at the Department of Administration. And I think Chair covered the issue very succinctly and well, and just to stand for any questions that you might have.
Is there any other persons wanting to testify to this? Okay. Committee members' question, Ms. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, given what we're going through at the national level regarding what is considered an emergency, I'm just wondering if we could come up with a good definition that would make sure that this really does just address emergencies rather than giving the administrator or the governor the latitude of using it as a way of bypassing the normal process.
Representative Feiberg.
Thank you, Representative Mason, Chair Sauk. I'm pretty sure this is only one subdivision in an existing section of statutes, and I would bet dimes to dollars that there is a definition of the term emergency, and I would also bet that Mr. Gehring, who has a statute book open right now and is looking through it feverishly, is about to point to that definition.
Mr. Chair, Representative Freiberg and Representative Mason, yes, so Chapter 12 of statutes is entirely devoted to emergency management, and there's a process in there for the governor to declare different types of emergencies depending on the situation, and I assume that the Department of Administration would kind of follow those practices in deciding whether this section would apply or not, but I would defer to the testifier on that.
Mr. Chair, members, in the example that was noted in 2015, there was a statewide emergency declared by the governor. And as a matter of fact, the legislature, I believe, came back in special session just to appropriate funds for this facility that was to be constructed in Wilmer. But we had essentially a 60-day process for selection of the design firm. And in this case, the delivery method probably would have made sense to be a design-build delivery method to really expedite this work. So, again, there was a statewide emergency declared in this case that we're referencing.
Representative Kill.
Representative Tice.
Tice.
Yes! Representative Keel isn't here.
You're going to, and you have every reason to take me to task because I just don't get it. I mean, my brain doesn't process it correctly.
That's okay. You're one of many.
It happens all the time.
Now it's hard to ask a serious question.
And I strain to find your name tag, and I can't. It's hidden there.
I'll put it right here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Freiberg. I guess I'm just a little bit concerned about, are there any limits to what can be bought since now we're changing it to public buildings? So I'm just a little concerned.
Mr. Chair, members, currently in statute, the commissioner has very broad purchasing as the chief procurement officer in emergency situations. Once an emergency has been declared, that authority is very broad. And obviously, it's subject to availability of funding and subject to obviously the oversight by the legislature as well as within the administration itself. This particular case happens to be the only known gap that we can see in statute where there is not existing authority to act promptly in an emergency. Other than that, currently in law, there is broad authority for the Commissioner of Administration to be able to facilitate procurement necessary to respond to emergencies.
Are there any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Freiberg. We're not aware of a Senate companion at this time, and so wondering, this sounds like an emergency, and so wondering if there's some urgency with this emergency to get something going in the Senate.
Representative Freiberg.
Representative Zerwas, you've brought up a point of deep shame with me. I can only assume that the Department of Administration is working feverishly around the clock to secure Senate authors of their administration priorities, and I would assume that is happening in this case.
Mr. Chair, I'll go on record as saying yes, that is happening.
Any other questions, committee? Representative Freiberg.
Thank you. This is a very important bill, one that I know the Senate will soon be tackling as well, and I have every confidence in that. So with that, I would love to have members' support of it, and I will renew my motion that House File 2056 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
If I had chair, I would say all those in favor.
Chattering in my I'm assuming you've moved the bill.
Yes, I renewed my motion.
Okay. So everybody in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Thank you. The bill moves forward. Now, we are prepared to either... Representative Fisher.
Representative Fisher has House File 2084. I will move that it be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee, what this bill does is it extends the sunset that's currently on the Legislative Water Commission. The Legislative Water Commission is set right now to expire and at the end of at this year on July 1st. It's been doing a lot of great bipartisan work the last few years. We've got a lot of bills that are coming through in a bipartisan way as a result of the commission. There are many bills that we work on and issues that we work on that just need a lot more time than we're able to do in committees here. And this is a committee that is commission that is equal members in both House and Senate and equal members on both evenly divided between both Democrats and Republicans. We've been able to get a lot of things done. We'd like to continue working on it because there's still a lot of water issues we need to be working on in the interim to be proactive as we move forward on the water issues in the future. And so we're asking for the sunset to be extended out for another 6 years.
Thank you. Representative Fisher, do you have any testifiers on your bill?
No, I do not.
Okay. Is there anybody in the audience who would like to testify on House File 2084? Okay. Seeing none, any member discussion? Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fisher, my understanding is if this legislation doesn't pass both bodies and signed by the governor this year, that the Water Commission would be sunset, it would go away.
That is correct.
Representative Fisher.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ross, that is correct. If we do nothing, the commission will expire on July 1st.
Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fisher, that sounds urgent. I'm wondering why there isn't a Senate companion for your bill and what your plans are to move the bill in the other body.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Zerwas. What ended up happening is over in the Senate, they've got a version that does not have a sunset on it. So what I did is I had this one introduced with the sunset on it. We will end up getting them matched up, from my understanding, and the intentions that we have is that they'll end up as combined with some other water bills that came out as recommendation from the Legislative Water Commission. We'll match them up that way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any additional member discussion? Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Fisher. Thank you for your leadership on water issues. I'm just curious, is Wiper Lake going to be overflowing this year with all the snow we've had? And do our neighboring communities need to be worried about your water coming into us?
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Lilly. First of all, you'll be safe in North St. Paul because there's a little bit of a water divide, so all that water will flow up. And if there is anything outflowing, it'll go up into Bald Eagle, so you're safe.
Any additional member discussion? Okay, seeing none, any closing remarks, Representative Fisher?
Would appreciate everyone's support to allow us to continue our hard work on water issues for the next 6 years. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I will renew my motion that House File 2084 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Okay, motion carries. Thank you, Representative Fisher. I think I'm just going to stay up here, even though it's my own bill, just because I might need some help here from staff. So, but I will bring back House File 1994. We've already had testifiers in support of it, as well as member questions. I wanted to make sure everyone had the amendment, which is in front of them. But I understand there is a potential issue because the original amendment, I don't believe that was, I believe the amendment that I have doesn't line up with the subcommittee engrossment. Do I have that correct, Mr. Gehring?
Mr. Chair, yeah. So the A2 amendment that was previously adopted is drafted with page and line references that reflect the subcommittee engrossment, which isn't in front of the committee right now. What you have in front of the committee is the introduced version of the bill. So to correct that, on page 1, line 4 of that amendment, you would delete the reference to line 11 and insert line 17.
Okay, so I guess I need the bill. We need the bill in front of us. So I'll move that House File 1994 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. So I think I need to do that first. And then I will move the A2 amendment with the change on line 1.4, changing the number 11 to the number 17. Is that correct? Okay. So all those, any discussion on the amendment? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the amendment is adopted. So we have the bill before us then, and is there anything else that needs to be done? Oh, the A1 amendment? Oh, is this amendment was adopted in the elections?
Right. Mr. Chair, so this A1 amendment was adopted in the election subcommittee and it would have been engrossed in the subcommittee report, but since you don't have that in front of you, what I would suggest is just adopting this again and just engrossing the bill that
way. Thank you for that suggestion. Is there any discussion to the amendment? Okay. What's that? Oh, yeah, I will move the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the motion carries. So now we have the bill in the correct form. Is there any discussion to the bill as amended? Okay. Seeing none, I will move. Thank you, members, for your indulgence here. Seeing none, I will move that House File 1994, as amended a couple times, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. I think we've gotten through the agenda, so we don't need to come back tonight.
Oh, man.
Yes, so our next meeting will be tomorrow, Wednesday, March 13th at 6:30 or at the call of the chair. So in room 300 North, I should mention, too, so we'll be in a different room. With that, I will adjourn the meeting.